What does it mean to do the right thing? Dharma, 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 Dharma Chameleon. Dharma Chameleon. How you feeling? Never mind the real thing, what's the right thing? Is a leftist chicken right-winged? Brace yourself, you just might feel a slight tinge while I work this out. Does a chameleon do the right thing? Or just code switch to be accepted? Irrespective of what is worn during an all-star game, not everyone always follows the same train of thought. Case in point, I will surely show up for another Spike Lee joint, as I'm sure Spike likes all humans. But then again, I'm just assuming. Like Spike, why not advocate for Iran and Sudan? I don't believe it was part of some master plan to steal the line, but if Denny is repping excellence in all the basketball, why not let him shine? Yes, doing the right thing does not mean following blind, but speaking truth to power, whether it be conservative talking points or filibustering for hours. Break out a pen and paper and trim the spin. I prefer to do the right thing with a W for the win. So as you develop, engulf, and envelop, do the white thing? Do the black thing? Nah, whatever you do, do the you thing.
Real Poets is an audio-only podcast that can also be visually read, like roses. Or when a director juxtaposes his or her most imposing reposes with characters, settings, and themes, composed of thrilling soundscapes, highest of stakes, and dreams. Hosted by a duo of real poets about real poets and the real poetry they've written and the films that have been written about them and their work.
Join us each week as we talk to another real poet with something to say and how a real poetry movie influenced them in some way. Then we each write a new poem inspired by our most recent viewing of the film and share it with all of you. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Real Poets. I'm Renzo del Castillo. For the first time ever, beside me is not Scott Raven, because he is celebrating his third anniversary today. And I have the distinct pleasure of welcoming E.M. Sims to the podcast. And you chose Do the Right Thing.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be in a space where we can talk about writing and movies. So thank you.
Now, you chose Do the Right Thing. Why is that?
Spike Lee is one of my top three favorite directors, writers of all time. I happened to be sitting with a group of friends not too long ago, and I was like, what's the movie that you would, it doesn't matter how many times you've seen it, if it's playing in the background, you just let it play, you can pick it up and drop it like an old friend that lives across the seas, but you're still like, you know, connected. And when it came around the circle to me, it was like, oh, see, it's easy, it's Do the Right Thing. Like, I can pick it up, drop it, I can't sit there and recite the words without watching it probably, but it's just, it resonates for me. And Spike Lee is one of those directors that I think is timeless, much like Shakespeare, because his stories, you can take them out of when they happened and they are still true today. So for me, it's a full circle, probably a little bit of a geeking out moment that I get to talk about my favorite director. I minored in film and I worked for 7 years at Blockbuster. So movies is my thing. I was watching movies with my dad when I was a kid. So yeah, it's just a pleasure. And as soon as I heard this podcast and the premise of it, like, I was like, oh my gosh, I know I want to write something. And I knew I always want to write something about Spike Lee. I just never got around to it. And this was just, it just came. It was instinctive. It was organic.
At first, when you mentioned it to me, I'm like, I don't know if this is a poetry movie, but thanks to you, when I really thought about just like fight the power as a refrain throughout the movie, key to atmosphere, the polyphony of many voices, the jump cuts and montage, the motifs of the boombox. Like, I think there's a strong case to consider this movie a poetic statement. So we're going to get into the movie in a bit, but you mentioned Spike Lee is not only as somebody you admire, but a great influence on you. Could you tell us a little bit about your poetry origin story?
I think my poetry journey started when I was a little kid, and I used to go into my older sister's stuff and saw her writing in a journal and kind of just wanted to do what she did. But something about her being like all of 12, 13 years old and writing words that, you know, like engulf and envelop, like those are words that still, I was like 6, 7 years old, and I remember seeing them in her pencil writing in a 5 subject notebook, you know, and that was probably my first moment of imprinting, if I could call it something. Throughout middle school, I think growing up, I wanted to be a dancer. And then when I got old enough to realize it wasn't going to pay the bills, I pointed my direction towards something else that I was really good at the time didn't seem like I had to work too hard to do. My poetry in my youth is adolescent, as it always is. It's coming of age stories, it's puberty, it's things of that nature. But I always like to play with language. And so at a very young age, I was putting Spanish into my poetry. And what evolved from that is an Afro-Latina experience in my poetry. So whether I'm talking about a flower or a car or something, it's innate for me to look at it through the lens of a second generation Dominicana. Like, my parents are Dominican, but I was born here, but I don't really fit. And it wasn't until recently that Dominicans were considered Latino. So it's all of that. It's a melting pot of those ideas in my poetry and in my prose as well. But that's kind of it. I think I answered the question.
You did. And it's interesting because a really good friend of mine is Afro-Latino, but he has this frustration because he's Black. People don't think he's Latino, right? They don't think he speaks Spanish, and he gets so offended. I understand why, but I think that you are calling to attention this need for representation. So can you tell us a little bit more about a perspective I can sympathize with, but I can't empathize with, which is the Afro-Latina perspective? Could you share a little bit more about, for our listeners, about what it is and how it impacted you growing up being represented?
Absolutely. Growing up in South Florida, I grew up watching Que Pasa USA with my sister and my cousins. And the Cuban culture resonates here. It's a beautiful culture. But it is all I knew growing up in Carroll City, which was predominantly African-American at the time in the 70s and the 80s. Being one of, at first, two sisters, I later, 12 years later, had a little sister. Yeah, my parents.
Built-in babysitter.
Go figure. But my parents, I would experience as a kid how people would look at them differently. Both my parents are Dominican. They were born across the street from each other. They fell in love with each other as adults. They were best friends until they came to this country and then decided to be romantic in that way. But my dad is very fair skinned. My mother is very dark skinned. And I would see how people would look at them. And then I would see how they would look at my older sister and I. I am, olive toned. My older sister is of darker complexion. People would always assume we had different parents. Or people always assume that if my dad were with both of us, my dad was babysitting her and I was his child. If I was with my mother and my older sister, she was my nanny that happened to take me along with her daughter. Like, we were never of the same family. And I was so offended by it as a younger kid, but I couldn't articulate it. So like Que Pasa USA, coming back to that, just bookending it, was the closest thing I got to what my household looked like. I came from a strict household. There were bars on the window. We weren't allowed to sleep over anybody's house because my mom thought that brothers and cousins and uncles, would do something to her little girl. Like, all of that, I was ingrained to think that I looked different than my sister. And this was coming from my mom. One thing that I struggle with in my writing is that my mom used to tell me as a kid, I don't understand you, Erica, when you speak English. And I'm like, what are you talking about? And she's like, you talk like them. My mom has a disconnect, or had, she's grown so much and I love her, but she had a disconnect with being darker skinned from a Caribbean island and how that differed to being darker skinned in America. So when she came here and they started to call her Black, she was like, no, I'm not. And since I speak Spanish, I'm white. Of course, they're looking at my mom like she's got three heads because she's like 8 shades darker than me. They think that she's probably kidnapped me. Those are all things that were reality to me. Like, people would look at us like, why is this woman holding this light child? And then the older I got, the more I felt like the other. And I started reading Gloria Azandulia. I started trying to figure out what the other was for me. And that was about the mestiza culture. So I still couldn't find like the right fit. I was like, okay, fine. Then, you're going to keep calling me Black, then I'm going to be Black. And I gravitated towards my Black culture. I embraced it. there are things that I still did that I now as an older adult, I'm like, oh, like I relaxed my hair and now I wear my hair naturally. When I went through my natural stage, my mom was the number one critic of how my hair was ugly. It was messy. It was untamed. How do you get a comb through it? Which is actually a line in the Spike Lee movie and Do the Right Thing. That was my reality. And I know my mom loves me. And I know to this day, my mom loves me. But it wasn't until recently, sadly to say, after George Floyd, my mom changed the color of her emoji on her iPhone, like from the Simpsons yellow to what her complexion actually looks like. That was a win for us. My sisters and I applauded her. Now my mom's hair is natural. So we're making baby steps. But that is what it was growing up for me. And all the while, my dad, being the fairer skinned of both of them, would contradict her. And he would do it very respectfully, but he would do it in front of her. And he would say, no, she's right. You know, Marina is my mom's name. She's right. So-and-so, she is Black. And you telling her that you don't understand when she's speaking English because you don't speak English properly is not okay. Now, these are conversations that we didn't have at the time. You know, I found out my dad had that conversation with her when I was much, much older. So they didn't, you know, still a Latin household. They don't fight in front of the kids. They don't argue in front. So I didn't know this was happening in real time. But as an adult, having these conversations now in hindsight, and I have two little girls, one who's incredibly fair skinned, and my older daughter is olive skinned, mocha skinned, same father, they're going to go through the same things. So my goal in my writing is to break these generational barriers that, albeit my parents didn't have the tools at the time to address them, I have them. So I can instill in them, love yourself, love your hair, love your skin, love the way that you talk. And if it's different, it's okay. You know? And so I guess full circle, that's where I'm at. That's what the Afro-Latina experience is. And now to have a title for it, because I wasn't walking around calling myself Afro-Latina back then. I'm like, I'm Black. And I happen to speak Spanish. So if you want to tutor in Spanish, I'm your girl. And that's who I was growing up.
That I can empathize with because I'm olive-skinned. I have an olive tone. But in Peru, I'm white. And my mom would say, we're white. And here I have to, when you start growing up and you're like, check a box. Are you Black? Are you white? Are you Pacific Islander? And I'm like, well, I don't find Peruvian because that was my concept of it. And it's like, no, you're white. And I'm like, I'm not. But it's, I think the term is like white passing. But in Peru, I would be white even though I am, yeah, I have like 60% European, but I'm also almost 40% Native, like Incan and Native American. And I also have African American through my grandmother. And it's interesting when you just start, there's something, and again, I'm not here to besmirch the Hispanic culture, but there's something about hegemonic power spheres when people are, when they are ostracized or minimized within a power sphere, they hold on to whatever power they can have within that.
It's hard to watch. It's hard to live.
Yeah, it's hard to understand. But I have a privilege to be able to consider that hard to understand because I have grown up in a very... Growing up, I was too Peruvian for the Americans and too American for the Peruvians. And at the end, I think I'm just a child of capitalism because I have the ability to say, I want to celebrate Christmas and open presents at midnight like I do in Peru, but I want to have eggnog on the next day. You know what I mean? So like it's like we can pick and choose what cultural aspects we want to define what we are, but why not? It goes back to representation. What happened to you when you discovered somebody like Afro-Dominican, like at least Elizabeth Acevedo? I mean, she brought the Poet X, right? I think that's what she wrote. Like that brought that slam cadence to young adult in the mainstream. Or you also have somebody like Melania Luisa Marte. She's also Dominican American. And she had a book called Plantains. Please let me get this right. Plantains and Our Becoming. Talking about colorism and Caribbean memory. And there's also like Afro-Peruvian, Victoria Santana Cruz. She did Me Gritaron Negra. And she's the mother of Afro-Peruvian performance. And there's more, right? There's Ariana Brown, Asia Monet. There's so many. What happened to you when you discovered that there were other women with a similar experience trailblazing within poetry?
Man, I picked up a pencil and I started to write. Like when I tell you I'm old. Old in the sense that after you graduate college and you land a job that has nothing to do with your degree, but it pays the bills and has good benefits. Like yeah. I'm living through a furlough. I have no problem saying it. I'm not going to lose my job because right now I'm going to work for free. But I have been doing this for almost 25 years of my life and it is security for my family. However, the pandemic shifted things for everybody, myself included. And when I started to tap back into the literary world because I completely walked away from it, I started to see representations of myself because that's my thing. Like there's a piece missing of my childhood where I picked up a book, loved it, but I didn't see myself in it. So in 2020, doing that and seeing the movement around me that had started years before that, and I was coming to the game late, I was like, look, Erica, it's the pandemic. We ain't got nowhere to go. I was getting divorced. I just had my second child. I was like, you do what makes you happy because tomorrow is today. I picked up a pen. I got a master's in 12 months. I got my MFA in creative writing. And I have not stopped since. I slowed down because life slows you down. So about a year ago, I got really sick and it came to a halt maybe 3 months ago. And I was basically bedridden. So all I did was write. All I did was write. I wrote like Erica, the 12-year-old. I wrote like Erica, the 22-year-old. I wrote like Erica, the 46-year-old. Looking back at Erica when she was 12, I looked inside myself in a way that I hadn't because I was able to, because all of those people that you've named and all of those unsung heroes created a space for me to feel comfortable where there wasn't a space before. Because the writing that I was doing as a kid, nobody was reading that. I had my own 5-subject notebook that was hidden in a closet somewhere underneath a mattress. It's inspiring. It means something when you can pick up a book and see yourself in it. Somehow, some way, shape, or form, the female voice, the Afro-Latina voice, I have body dysmorphia. So I was seeing that too. I was seeing how the echoes of my mom as a kid saying, no coma eso, tiene tendencia a gordar. And she said that my entire life. And it isn't until now at 46 that she's looking at me like, you know, why are you having these issues? And I'm like, ma, this happens. And that led to this.
No, nunca.
No, that's exactly right. What exactly. She said. She was like, how is it that all this was happening and I didn't know? And I was like, because you were out there making that money for us and I wasn't eating. And it, you know, so anyway, it's just being able to see somebody do something that represents the things that you're feeling, that for me is a get up and go. It was just a moment for me. And I have 2 girls and it was all of it coming together.
It's relatively recently, but in the short time that I've known you, you seem to me like a go-getter, like somebody who's very driven. In that short amount of time, I knew that your girls were your inspiration. I knew that your marriage didn't work out, but you had a good relationship with your former husband in order to bring a good life to your girls, the importance of your family, the importance of you being Dominican. Do you feel, now that you've seen what these women have done and created a path for you, do you feel a responsibility or do you feel driven to contribute to that legacy?
Absolutely. Both driven and inspired, driven to help to break generational barriers for young little girls that live inside of me, inspired to the point where I'm 2 steps away from a manuscript of a chapbook being published and stuff that I've been working on. Listen, I'm telling you, I stayed in bed for all this time and I wrote and rewrite and write and rewrite. My goal is to have this chapbook out by December. It is dedicated to my girls. Like you picked up on that. The go-getter thing, I'm a victim. I'll be the first one or, you know, a proponent, a cheerleader. I don't even know the right noun of imposter syndrome. I am constantly getting to that line and finding a way to drag myself back away from it instead of crossing over it. And this moment, and by that I mean maybe the last 6 to 9 months, this moment, something in me has catapulted me across the line. So I see my book in print. I see me hustling. I see me going to open mics. The open mic I went to where I met you was my 2nd open mic. The stuff about me being on the stage, it makes it so much more rewarding because I can bring that to the table also. That's kind of how I deal with my anxiety. If I can get it on the stage and I can perform it, I'm okay. But if I have to sit here and do a cold read and like, I can't articulate it. So all of those things coming together make it possible. And yeah, no, I'm dropping gems. I'm gonna drop them left and right wherever I can. So that other little girls and little boys, because I feel like little Latino boys are lost too, and they don't know how to treat us and we don't know how to treat them, you know? So I want to be able to leave stepping stones for the next generation to at least know how to navigate some of the stuff that, some of the chaos that we all have to experience.
You're closer to the Fort Lauderdale area, right? I don't want to give specific addresses, but the reason for that being is I live in Miami. We're in South Florida. I'll give you an example. I was in Dublin a year and a half ago. I was in Dublin, right? And Dublin is the city of James Joyce. It's Seamus Heaney, Oscar Wilde, right? Like all of these different people. And it's considered a literary city, but we're not. Miami has an international reputation for being fun, perhaps a little shallow, very young. But Miami's been here for a while. And it's a center for Latin American and Caribbean migration. It's a center for world migration. It's a port city. Economically, it's incredibly viable to the U.S. All of the important issues that are affecting our country, our world right now, immigration reform, Medicaid, Medicare fraud, women's reproductive rights, right? Like a lot of these things are happening here. So I believe if you look deeper, there are many talented, beautiful people that have something to say. So why not Miami? All of that to say, what role does community play in your work?
Huge. Huge. My screenplay, not a shameless plug, but I have a pilot that's called Plátanos in Carroll City. And it's about Carroll City. It's not about Miami Gardens. It's about Carroll City. It's about Joe Robbie Stadium. It's about what it was like to be in that area in the 70s and in the 80s. And it's about my version of Que Pasa USA. It really is. But community is everything for me. One of the things I love to do is drive. I'm a road trip gal, so I love to drive everywhere. I'm in the middle of, you know, Miami, Fort Lauderdale area. I'm not that far north. But I mean, for my art and my craft, I will travel wherever I can. But my roots are always in the 305. Like I graduated from a school in Fort Lauderdale, a performing arts school in Fort Lauderdale. But I was being bused from Carroll City every day at 4 a.m. to get there.
I was a magnet kid too. I know about those 2 hour bus drive.
Yeah. 2 hour bus drive. The sun ain't even up yet. My older sister was the first graduating class of New World. This is the stuff that we were used to. So I can't tear myself away from where I came from. And if the little bit that I do is enough to bring what's needed in Miami literary rise, like, dang, I would love to be part of that movement. Like I am such a flower child and I see the possibility of that and power in numbers. Like, yeah, no, but it's always Miami. I'm a Miami girl. I'm a Carroll City girl. I was born in Hialeah, raised in Carroll City, and that's going to be with me forever. And it is going to resonate in my writing because I feel like whenever you see Florida, whenever you see Miami in writing or in film, it's accurately, painfully inaccurate or overly glamorized. Nowhere in the middle, and a lot of us are left out.
Yeah,
a lot of us are left out. So you know,
I feel like Moonlight approached something.
Oh, like Moonlight was, right?
Moonlight something was wrong, but it's the outlier. To your point,
it is. It's the anomaly. It's the one that stands out that nobody else is doing the same thing. It's also Tallahassee, Florida State. I got to prop my alum. Oh, poor. Listen, we both lost. So you can
chomp. Not this year. Not this year.
Yeah, we both lost.
You guys are good, though. I have no hate.
But no, yeah, it's a community is definitely everything. And because I know that my parents always go home, like they go to DR at least 5, 6, 7 times a year. They're retired, of course. But even when they weren't, they would go 3, 4, 5 times a year. I traveled with my birth certificate when I was a baby before I was a year old. It's stamped all on the back of it, the microfiche, old school looking birth certificate. And so they would take us every summer. And no, I've never been to a resort in DR. Have no idea what they look like. All I know is city life. I know my family. I know the power goes out at this time. I know it comes back that time. I know how to flush a toilet with a bucket of water. That was my upbringing. So the fact that my parents taught us that makes me think that the love I have for the community I came from, it's my connection. It's the example they gave me. And all of my memories, good, bad, or indifferent, came from me being in Carroll City for 18 years. That's what I know. And no one else knows about it. It just seems like it's just a little hole. Like they know about Hialeah, Miami Beach, definitely, Fort Lauderdale. And then, you know, that's all it. That's all of Florida.
Exactly. Well, just to go back to the DR, I mean, Don't sleep on the fact you're ambassador to the world in Juan Luis Guerra. Whenever I'm in Santo Domingo, the man just walks around like he's a former
god.
Everybody's in awe of him, but pays respect, and he's just part of the community. And he's just like at church every Sunday, just like you can go hear him do a concert every freaking Sunday.
And it's free. He's one of the most humble people in the world. And that's the thing about Dominican artists. I can only speak for what I know. My parents have a rapport with him. My parents have a rapport with Fernandito Villalona. My parents had a rapport with, at some point, La Chicas del Can when I was younger.
Oh my God.
You could go into regular establishments to eat and they were there and you talk to them like family. Like I met Sergio Vargas when I was 15 and I will never forget that. But I see him now and he's like, oh, Fefita's hija. Like he knows me. He probably doesn't remember that, but he knows who I, like it's that tight knit culture, like community that we don't have here. Like I can't tell you what my neighbors to the left and right's names are. I have no clue.
First of all, I love Juan Luis Guerra. But the reason that I mention him is that there is such a beautiful literary history and connotation that comes with DR. If you just think of something like Estrellitas y Duendes, right? Viviré en tu recuerdo como un simple aguacero de estrellitas y duendes. That's a pop song and it's poetry. We grew up with all like Burbujas de Amor, all of this stuff, Bachata Rosa.
Mm-hmm. But gosh, that was at every quinceañera. Bachata Rosa was like what everybody danced to.
It's a little weird.
But it was poetic.
When I realized that all, like in my family growing up, everybody slow danced with their daughters to Burbujas de Amor, I was like,
so weird.
When I realized what it was, you know, so I was just like, it's still beautiful, but I'm like, oh.
Not appropriate for what that
for,
is.
For, yeah.
The wedding, but, a husband and a wife,
exactly.
A father and a daughter.
Exactly. Yeah. There is this beautiful literary tradition where you come from. And I think there's also a artistic tradition where you come from. And I think there is a beautiful artistic tradition where you are also from, which is Miami. With all of that context and all of that percolating inside you, what are you interested in now? I don't want to generalize, right? So I'm asking, what are the topics that normally inspire you to write? Like, what are you working on?
Aside from poetry, I have been dabbling with my manuscript. I am working on my first book, putting the Afro-Latina experience aside, because it's part of my writing. It is who I am. But I don't want to typecast myself either.
It's
right?
Not all of you either.
It's not all of me. I enjoy and have always enjoyed the supernatural, just feeling the spirits, which is also, you know, indicative of the Dominican Republic, the Hispaniola, Haiti, you know. Also, something that was part of my experience was, you know, my aunts and my mom and everybody having dreams and seeing things. And then as a kid, I started seeing things. And so ghost stories for me have always been love stories for me. Always. And I don't necessarily mean your traditional love between man and woman. It translates to your love between grandparent and grandchild, mother and daughter. Yeah. So my fiction is encouched in that, the idea that there are presence around us, not necessarily telling us what to do, but just there. And I don't know how to articulate the there other than to show and not tell, but it's definitely a relationship between the afterlife and characters that are very much alive, that are seeing what's happening. It's not scary in any way, shape, or form. It's more romanticized. Yeah, there's this weird morbid love I have for ghosts. So I'm nowhere near halfway done with my manuscript, but I do have, you know, milestones. And so I'm chipping away at that. But yeah, it's a love ghost story. Let's leave it at that.
Ghost love story. You're Patrick Swayze-ing it.
Right? No, please. Oh.
What themes do you dig into in your poetry? What fascinates you? What are you inspired to write about, whether it be poetry, whether it be... Obviously, the supernatural is one of them. Do you have any others?
Unrequited love is a biggie for me. And again, I don't necessarily mean in the sense of traditional man, woman, man. I don't mean, you know, romantic love. I mean just love that's not reciprocated. And I think that comes from me being a Pisces, me being an empath, me being the type of person that will do everything for everyone else and forget about me. There's this idea of unrequited love, unrequited reciprocity, unrequited, unconditional love that I search for in my writing. And it pops up a lot. The poem I wrote tonight is a love poem. It's not going to sound like one, but it's a love poem.
I'm so looking forward to hearing that when we get to that piece, to that point where we talk about the movie. Let me ask you about love just for a little bit before we get in, because there's an aspect of the movie that I want to start with, this love thing. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine actually today. I was on my walk, I was talking on the phone, and we were talking about unconditional love. And I don't believe, and I would like for you to challenge me, agree with me, disagree with me, just talk to me about it. I don't believe unconditional love exists, not even between a mother and a kid, because the second I didn't go to the school my parents wanted, or the second I didn't follow the major, like there were conditions. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm not saying it's a negative thing. It's probably as close to unconditional as you get, but I think there will always be something that is transactional about it. You do this and you get this from me. When you write about unconditional love, what is it you dig into? Do you believe that exists? Is it an ideal to strive for?
I'm actually becoming a skeptic to if it exists or not. I am a hopeless romantic, and my mom has always taught us, I love you so much that it doesn't matter what you do. Doesn't matter how bad you mess up, doesn't matter what you do, doesn't all those things, I'm gonna love you anyway. But you're right. I didn't get into New World. My mom was highly disappointed that I didn't get into New World. That was very transactional interaction. I didn't say much. I heard a lot and I just sat there and took it. And then I felt like crap, went in my room, cried about it, wrote about it, and listened to New Kids on the Block. It was over. Like it was bad. I want to believe that it exists, but I don't think it's fair to ask that of someone else, because to believe in unconditional love means that you would have to put the person, the idea, the notion before you. And having lived through mental health challenges, I know that I can't do anything for anyone else until I do it for myself. I think you can have unconditional love with yourself. And I think a lot of us don't do that. And that's probably why we fail at things. And so I actually challenge myself to give myself the unconditional love that I look for outwardly. And I think that's what in my poems I'm trying to reach for. Like I've gotten to the point where I understand that this ideal does not exist. Not because I haven't found a man that hasn't been able to. I mean, my father is wonderful. He put my mom, I mean, they've been married for 50 some odd years. Like they exist.
Yeah, proof of concept for sure.
Absolutely. So it exists, and they went through some stuff that, I mean, I've been divorced twice. I would have probably been divorced 8 times if I was married to my mom and or my dad. So I don't know how they do it. Realistically, as hopelessly romantic as I am, I'm also realistic about, because I've been burned, I've been hurt, I've been jaded, I put my eggs all in one basket. I've thrown, the sink at it and given my all in quotes to be let down. But the truth of the matter is that I set myself up to fail. I'm the only person that's letting anyone down is me, because I've constructed this ideal for this person to step into, but it's my ideal, it's not theirs. I think asking for unconditional love removes the person's autonomy. It removes their individuality. And as sad as that is to say to my romantic heart, it's truly how I feel. And I think that's what I fight with writing poetry, writing the fiction. In fiction, ironically, I struggle with love scenes. I struggle with it quite a bit. Not that because it sounds hokey, but because as a recipient of the line that's being fed to them, I'm like, this is bullcrap. Like this, like, okay, that's what I'm saying today, but that's not how I'm gonna feel tomorrow. I'm real about it. And I don't think that you get to this point unless you experience a shitload of stuff to get you to this point. So yeah, at 12, I absolutely thought unconditional love existed. 46, I wanted to, but I don't think so. Like, I don't really think so.
I think unconditional love isn't real. And I don't mean it in the sense like it can't exist. It's just like it's not real. I can't touch it. I
Not
can't feel
tangible.
it, right? I'm very Blakean in the sense of romance, where I've become so, meaning like a rose is beautiful because it's finite. Like, let's enjoy what we have while it's here. True, this point of view has been informed by years of therapy. But it really comes down to, like, I remember I love my parents. They're great people. My dad was a great guy, but they were flawed, right? Nobody's perfect. And I was talking to my therapist about X, Y, and Z, and she told me, Renz, think about it this way. You want orchids, and your parents are beautiful roses. Now, you can either spend your days wishing these roses were orchids, or you can enjoy the rose as an example. Or when it comes to love, I know that I'm a better partner when I'm a bit more selfish. And what I'm, and I mean this in the very Hispanic sense, like
yes.
Love is supposed to be, I grew up thinking, like, I didn't have a room for most of the time I was growing up because my parents, even though we were struggling, were always helping people out, bringing them in. And of course, they sacrificed my room because I was the boy. The boy could sacrifice the room. The girl, oh no, we can't have anybody in the room. Great. But I grew up with this thing that love is sacrifice and you give it all up. And then later I see my mom being extremely bitter about, like, I could have had this, but I gave it up. And I'm like, but you made that choice. And then I also grew up with this framework of like, oh, if I love someone, I'm going to sacrifice my joy. But it came at the cost of my joy, which
my joy.
Mm-hmm. My cup was empty. When my cup is empty, I'm no good to anyone. So now I have a rule. I have to want to do something and I have to be able to do something. If I don't want to do it and I'm able, I don't owe you a damn thing. If I want to do it, but I'm not able, I can't do it. I'm so sorry. But if I'm able and I can, I'm the most generous person you know. What I found is when I'm able to take care of myself, and I had to do a lot of work because as a recovering people pleaser, I didn't know what filled my cup. So when I filled my cup, oh, it's so much easier. Like even if your partner's having a rough day and if your cup is full, you're like, oh, don't worry about it. We can talk about it later. But if your cup is empty, you're like, well, I have to question where we are, right? Because I'm too exhausted to deal with it, right? How this ties back to love, you hit on something that resonates with me, which is maybe you won't get to unconditional love, but love yourself, respect yourself, be kind to yourself, treat yourself as you would like, as you would treat others, or as you ideally would treat others. And that allows you to give what you have. A good friend of mine made the analogy of like, you know, you're like the dude that's on an airplane and it's going down and you're trying to put the oxygen mask on everybody else and not yourself because you'd feel too guilty mm-hmm. about one person you wouldn't get to if you took time to do it for yourself. But if you do it for yourself, you'd get to more people.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Right. So when it comes to poetry, I do love exploring all different sides. And there's so many more we haven't talked about, but at least in terms of like unconditional love and conditions, is conditions really that bad? Are you wrong for wanting to be loved in a certain way? Is that, does that make you an inconvenience? I don't think so.
But I think so. It just makes me not good for you.
Exactly. But I think we grow up with that, like, oh, I don't want to make noise. Remember, good kids are the ones who, oh, you never made a sound. You never complained. You were such a good kid. And I was like, now I'm like, oh, I just didn't assert my need. And that made me very repressed. So anyway, what you said really just sparked a something in me. But there is something else that you mentioned about being Afro-Latina, but also being American and being a woman and being the space. And it makes me think of the Wall of Fame and Do the Right Thing, Sal's Wall of Fame. And what was bugging out, calling, it was Giancarlo Esposito. And we're going to get in. And he's calling out Sal for saying like, hey, there's no Black representation on your Wall of Fame. And he's like, hey, this is my Wall of Fame. I get to put whoever I want on it. And it just so happens they're all Italian Americans. To me, that calls out who gets space, who is allowed or able to take up space, whether in our public consciousness, whether in our literary consciousness. How does the concept of space within any space impact your life?
I mentioned the other a lot earlier, and it's not just a color thing. It's a gender thing. Baldwin says it best, and I am going to butcher it. But in short, he says the woman is the world's nigger. It is what it is. I don't think the first few times I watched it, I thought, why are there no women on the wall? I was like, why ain't no Black people on the wall? But the more I watched it, the more I stopped identifying with Mookie, which is weird because, you know, you would think I would identify with the females more. No, I identified with Mookie. I was with Mookie. I didn't Mookie do the right thing. No, but when I stop and I start to put myself in Jade, the sister's position, or mother, sister, the older woman in the movie. Yeah, those spaces are almost blocked off. They have not as much dialogue. And when they do, it's at levels of extreme feeling. I feel that we're not born in a vacuum, right? Wherever we step, we have to step louder, twice as fast, just to even be seen Forget about opening your mouth and speaking. If you're seen, then you got to get a seat at the table. And who's sitting at that table? And if you're sitting at the table, are you going to wait your turn to talk or are you going to talk? For me, as I am weirdly an extroverted introvert, I have my moments where I'm incredibly reserved. And my writing sometimes shows that, where I take on a role like Jade the sister, where I'm providing lesson, like, you know, the Canterbury Tales, like, do this, don't do that. But then I don't have an opinion about said lessons. Bringing it back to Sal's wall, Jade didn't have an opinion. Jade is like, leave Sal alone. You know, of course, Mookie's coming at her like he wants to bone you. And she's not seeing it that way. She's just like, he's just trying to be nice. He's just a nice guy. She's enamored by the attention of a white man. But then again, she's enamored by the attention of a white man and none of the black men in her community. So what does that say about what's available to us as women in these spaces? And what we're, I don't want to say programmed, but taught, what we're taught to accept as acceptable. I can go back and watch Singing in the Rain and find in the first 20 seconds of that reel, a whole bunch of offensive things, but I love Gene Kelly, you know? Yeah. But again, that was a space where women were not seen, let alone heard. And if you happen to be a white woman or a fair-skinned woman or you're passing like Lana Turner, then maybe you can get your foot in the door. But otherwise, not really. Yeah, it's a difficult place to maneuver. And we all can't be like Ava DuVernay, where we're breaking and shattering the roof off the walls of this establishment. But we definitely have to try, because we don't have a space. I don't think that we do. I think that we've created these spaces for ourselves in writing, in film, where it's not that there wasn't a space, they just didn't want to give us a space.
Or feel the need. Or even consider that others should have a say as well within the space.
Correct. Like
that's the biggest thing. I know that I was an executive in healthcare. I'm a consultant now, aside from doing poetry. And I remember I had a very big aha moment, because it wasn't me. I wasn't doing it. But whenever I went out with colleagues who were women, who were also higher ranking than me, I didn't notice that men would come introduce themselves. I was in the group, but they would always introduce themselves to me, not to them. Mary was the one who called it out. Do you notice that this is what happens? And I'm like, yeah. So now, like, I know I can't change the world, but I try to say like, oh, basically direct the conversation to make it more, to make it more holistic all around, to be more inclusive all around. I was living off that privilege, coasting, unaware, blissfully unaware, until my eyes were open. And I try to do something about it now. I know I'm not changing the world, but at least I'm changing that moment to be more comfortable for my colleagues. So it's interesting when it comes to spaces. And when you think about like just rank, even though I don't really set much store with it now, they're higher ranking in terms of the business area where we're talking than the dude coming in to introduce a concept or start a conversation or whatever. So it's just, it's everywhere. I think we just don't, when you're privileged, you don't see it. So you're not
I don't even know. I think I had a moment where I was, because it wasn't until much, much later I'm in the government now. I'm in management at this point. And there is someone above me and I have my own little Me Too moment. But at 23 years old, I don't realize that it's a moment until like 2020, 2019, 2020, 2021, when this whole Weinstein stuff comes out. And I'm like, wow, that really did happen to me. And they used to tell me to go talk to this certain office manager all the time, because I could get whatever they wanted us to do with the office, send M, because she can persuade him. I didn't realize that the way that they were using me to persuade him was based on my looks. I had no clue until I was 20, 30 years later. So even then, I think that we walk around, women of color, women walk around with a bit of privilege, thinking that it doesn't pertain to me, particularly when you move up that ladder, that hierarchy ladder, where, okay, well, we're all management now. We're all on the same playing field. We're all making sure that these group of people are safe and they're doing their job. But when you're in that room and it's you and four other people, and three of them are men and two of them, you know, it's a very difficult space to be in. And I still get it to this day. For me to correct the moment, you know, I really address it. Hello, you know, I put myself out there as much as I can without being obnoxious and annoying. And in groups where I see that I am being neglected, I walk away, which before I never did. I always wanted to feel like I belonged. I wanted to feel, no, I just, okay.
Yeah.
This group is not for me. It's time for me to find another group. And I simply walk away, which is something that was really hard to do as a people pleaser, like walking away and, oh, they're not necessarily going to remember me or, you know, my thoughts, and they're not going to think I'm smart. And no, none of that matters, because I'm not going to waste my time on someone that's not going to acknowledge me as a person.
Yeah, it's interesting. And again, I just want to be very clear. I'm not saying like, oh, forgive them for they know.
Oh, no, you. I know.
That's not what, no, I'm just like, hey, listeners, that's not what I'm saying. But there is this thing where it's like, it's taken for granted. And I would encourage anybody to do some introspection about what spheres they inhabit and what power they have, and if they can provide a platform for somebody else to have a voice. So we're starting to get into it. Why don't we talk about Do the Right Thing? I'm going to give a quick synopsis and then we're going to get right into it. This movie came out in 1989, considered one of, I think Sight and Sound had it in its top 50 for sure as the best movies of all time. On the hottest day of summer in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, simmering tensions across one block reach a flashpoint. Mookie, a delivery man at Sal's Pizzeria, navigates loyalties to his neighborhood and his employer as conflicts over representation and respect escalate. When Sal, his employer, smashes Radio Raheem's boombox, the confrontation draws police, who kill Raheem in a chokehold, sparking a riot that raises the shop. The next morning offers no easy answers, only the question the title poses. Writer-director Spike Lee, 1989, produced by 40 Acres and a Mule Filmworks and Universal Pictures. We have Spike Lee as Mookie, Danny Aiello as Sal, recommended by Robert De Niro, who was the original inspiration for Sal, Ossie Davis as the mayor, Ruby Dee as Mother's sister, Giancarlo Esposito as Bugging Out, Bill Nunn as Radio Raheem, John Turturro as Pino, Rosie Perez in her first role as Tina, Samuel L. Jackson as Mr. Senor Love Daddy, and Roger Genver Smith, I hope I pronounced that right, as Smiley. The cinematography was by Ernest Dickerson. Music was by Bill Lee, Spike's father. He's a jazz musician for the score, and an amazing soundtrack with Public Enemies Fight the Power as a thematic anthem. It was 120 minutes. It's rated R. You were talking about the spaces women inhabit, and Rosie Perez had her film debut. Her opening dance over the credits sets the film's physical rhythm, but she also plays Mookie's baby mom, right? His girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a very uneasy experience with her nude scene. I remember reading that they don't show her face when Spike Lee is putting ice on her nipples. She was crying. And they're still friends. He apologized for it afterwards, but that was her experience in this movie.
Did anybody stop and ask the child if she was okay before she took a top off? Probably not. Was there a therapist on set like they do now when they have love scenes? Probably not, because that was a very low-budgeted movie. He's probably paying for it with his 40 acres and his mule that he never got. Even the dance sequence at the beginning, former dancer. We know Rosie Perez as being a dancer of...
Soul Train. She was on
Soul Train. Soul Train, the Soul Train line, and doing the same moves, for lack of a better term, gyrating, popping, dropping it, whatever. And that went viral. And it re-went viral again during the pandemic because she was unapologetically feeling the beat. So he had her reenact that in the opening scenes. But I look at it as a dancer and can tell you that if there are 50 eyes on me, 30 of them have cameras, boom mics everywhere, and it's just me, and they're looking at me wearing that I was wearing. And she has like three or four different costume changes in that opening scene where they flash back and forth. She's wearing tight red, then it goes to tight blue, then it's cut off with boxer shorts because she's got the boxing gloves on. All of that is provocative. Again, did they stop and ask the child, was she okay? Probably not. But did she internalize it and turn it into dancing because she is a dancer in my heart? Probably she did. because that's what we do. That's what we females do. We take that anxiety and we turn it into art somehow. I didn't know the piece about her crying. I did notice again, I watched Inside Man yesterday and then I rewatched Spike.
I didn't watch it the weekend like I promised you I would.
I watched it and now I have something to say about Casa de Papel. Like I got something to say, but no, that's for another day. That's for another day.
Okay, guys, just FYI, Inside Man, phenomenal. Still holds up.
Fantastic. Clive Owen, Denzel, toe-to-toe. I'm done. So yeah, getting back to it, I didn't know that she was crying in that scene. And that's why, you know, that one of the reasons you don't see her face, but I did notice in watching it back today, I wanted to watch it fresh. All of those scenes, you don't see her face at all. When he tells her to stand on the bed and wait for him to go get the ice, you only see from her thighs down. You don't even see her buttocks. Like you just see her thighs and her legs and she's like, what are you doing, Rookie? And then she comes back. You've got these really obtrusive close-ups that Spike Lee is known for. So you know you've got something in her face when he's doing the eyebrow and the nose and God, thank God for the lips and all that, you know, and the thigh and the knee. But I didn't realize that. And that put things into perspective for me because I think that at that point, she probably didn't have a voice. And if she did, she probably couldn't use it. And if she used it, somebody probably made her feel better in quotes about it. And she got through it.
Yeah. And it's also interesting because it's almost a commodification of her body. It's getting cut up in editing and put out there. I remember I was reading up on some of the reviews that Do the Right Thing came out, and a lot of them were complimentary, but some of them that weren't, I think it may have been the LA Times, I'm not sure, don't quote me on that. He said that Spike Lee does to Black women in his movies what white directors do to white women in theirs. At the beginning of his career, maybe true.
You've got Call Girl 6, you got She Gotta Have It. Think of it this way, because that's not, you know, I looked at it as the woman finally able to embrace her sexuality. Now, the editing part, now that I look at it, yeah, no, that is.
This is still an early film, right? I'm not trying to, it's not.
An oh, no. It's just got me thinking. I think out loud.
But it's what you said, right? Like, as a Black man, I'm going to expose this thing, but I'm still a man. And in this sphere, men, women, the dynamic, there's a power dynamic that's shifting.
He knows who he's playing up to. Like, he's not dumb. Like, no. By no means, he's got a wonderful eye. And he has those type of cut shots and She's Gotta Have It, the movie and the series. He does that to Nola quite often. But I think Nola likes it. There's something to say about a woman liking being the Madonna at some point. And I'm going to be really honest about it, because you're not going to have too many women confess their ego when someone puts you on that Grecian urn, Keats's Grecian urn, you know, and then when you finally get the urn, you're like, oh, it's just fucking urn. that's the Madonna. Like, think about when you're first in a relationship and it's blooming and everybody's wooing everybody and you're so beautiful and you're so wonderful and you can't do nothing wrong. And the woman is just exalted. God forbid she does one thing wrong and she's dropped on a head from very, very, very high. But don't get it twisted. There are women out there, myself included, that at some point adored being adored like that. So for us to sit here and say, damn, she got the short end of that. She was cut all up. They don't even know if that's her or not. If it is, you know, you can't really see that she's full figured because you just see these pieces of her. So you don't really see the representation of the Latina woman anyway. So is he really trying to represent her? Is he just trying to push her off as passing because her scenes are cut that way? Probably. But there are women that like to be cut up that way. And I mean that in the sense that, like, you know what I mean? I'm not saying she was.
I love that people assume that I can just dance because I'm Hispanic. I love it.
It is.
And other things. I love that people assume those other things, right? But it's just, I don't know. We get
it's problematic.
It is, because this is the thing. I think the world is information overload, and stereotypes have always played an important part. It's just the way that you take in information. And the only thing to replace a stereotype has been another stereotype. As an example, I mean, we're talking about women of color in film. Mammy from Gone with the Wind, Hattie McDaniel, was replaced by the Maya Angelous of the world. Like, it's this evolution, but it hasn't been deconstructed and removed. It's been replaced.
Revised and replaced.
Anthony Ramos was in She's Gotta Have It in the series.
Yes.
You know that his mom was played by Rosie Perez.
Yes.
And she was Tina.
So allegedly, Mookie is his dad. Yeah. Allegedly. But then I said, well, then isn't his name Hector? Because then I got two.
No. It could be another son. They never said.
I know, but then it could be another son. And I'm like, but Tina said she was done with him. And I'm like, well, wait a minute.
But we all know Tina wasn't done.
I know. And the thing is, he pops up there, and he pops up in another Spike Lee film where he has a very small role as Mookie. It has Red in the title. It's good, though. It's a good flick. Red Hook Summer. Mookie pops up again, sitting on the couch, and he's referred to as Mookie, but he's a grown-up Mookie. And I'm like, well, hold. And then I saw the series She's Gotta Have, and I'm like, well, when did he? How did? And all of a sudden, I want to write Mookie's story. Like, all of a sudden, I'm in it.
Well, let's talk about Mookie, right? Because for a movie called Do the Right Thing, I don't think anybody does the right thing, really.
You don't think Mookie does the right thing at the end?
Throughout the movie, the motivation, there's nobody that I like enough to say this is the nice person or the good person or the one that I identify. Mookie's selfish as hell. He is not good to Tina, okay?
No, he's not.
This is what I'm saying. Like, I'm not saying he's not the protagonist or the hero, but he is a flawed hero. I think Sal could be, he's the knight. Look how Jade feels about him. But is he the knight?
Treats Smiley. Like, he treats Smiley with kindness.
Exactly.
No? None of them do the right thing. I think you're absolutely right. And I think that Spike is taking the age-old three-act play, and he's building up on turning point after turning point, and he's putting all of them in these roles where they have to make a choice. And they end up not making a necessarily favorable choice for themselves and or others. The irony in the film is that they don't do that. The question is, does he do that at the end? And we're not there yet.
Well, you know what? No, let's go to the end. Bugging out enlists Raheem, Radio Raheem, the iconic character in this film who has this awesome soliloquy on love and hate that's straight out of Night of the Hunter with Robert Mitchum, which is a fantastic film if you haven't seen it. Radio Raheem is the only one who's like, I'll protest Sal's pizzeria with you because he won't put any black people on the Wall of Fame. And they come in and they're loud. Sal tells them to get out. A confrontation happens and he busts Radio Raheem. Boombox. Starts a fight. Cops come in, choke out Raheem. He dies. We have Mookie who grabs a trash can and starts the riot by throwing it through the window of Sal's pizza joint, and Sal's pizza parlor gets destroyed, and then more stuff happens. But that is the inflection. If this was a poem, that was the volta, right? That was the inflection point of the movie. Before we get into it, you know, like, just some critics, the question is, did Mookie redirect the rage towards Sal and save his life by throwing it and destroying his property? Or did he fall into destructive violence? Or are we calling to attention people trying to compare the destruction of property to the life of a black man? There's different ways that this has gone on. So the question that you asked, and since you asked it, I am going to start with you. Did Mookie do the right thing?
I'm going to answer you like an Afro-Latina that I am. Mookie did do the right thing. Not necessarily for the three reasons that you mentioned, which all of them are worth diving into. But knowing that Spike is the writer-director and has placed himself in the role of the protagonist, has placed himself behind the lens, has played around with breaking the fourth wall, but never does. For me, him breaking that glass is breaking the fourth wall for us, the movie viewers, to actually see the violence that happens all day long. Did I feel like that pre-Floyd? To a degree, because I had seen some Twilight Zone episodes that reminded me of the breaking of the fourth wall, and to a degree. Post-Floyd and the cameras and even Jordan Peele's remake of Twilight Zone, where he has that one episode where they're trying to get to a black college, an HBCU, and they have to take an underground tunnel. But then when they get to the college, everybody's there, you know, and there's white of police officers or whatever. And all of the college students are there with their video phones, taking a camera, you know, and recording what's happening. For me, post 2020, it resonated because it took videotaping the death of a man for the world to stop. And we were stuck in a pandemic where we couldn't go nowhere. And Mookie breaking the glass for a moment, there's silence. There is no jazz music playing. There's the shattering of the glass, and then the chaos ensues. For Mookie, breaking the glass wasn't enough. And it isn't until March of 1991, 2.5 years later, that we have Rodney King. So he's already ahead of the curve saying, we need to shatter this glass and we need to let everyone else see what's happening here. So I took it from a more cinematic perspective. First time I saw this movie, I was in college. Maybe my parents rented it when I was a kid, but I really didn't understand it. And then I watched him much more as an adult. And the more I saw it, the more I'm like, nah, he's breaking the director's lens. He is showing us, not even showing, he's making us feel what it is to be in that moment, to witness the death of somebody else and not be able to do anything about it.
Well, because he puts the camera on Mookie's perspective, right? That point of view, like those spike close-ups. None is looking straight at the camera, straight at the viewer, right? So it's almost like he's inviting us to say like, hey, I'm going to talk to you about this violence, but I'm also going to make you a participant. You're in this movie now.
Correct.
I'm going to talk to you about what love and hate is. And, you know, Rodney King happened after, but I believe this was inspired by, in 1986, there was some incident at Howard Beach, Queens, and he was talking about this with Robert De Niro, and the incident involved an attack on a number, I don't remember how many African-American men in a predominantly Italian-American neighborhood, and one of the men was struck by a car and killed. To your point, it was also, the episode Shopping for Death of The Twilight Zone. The increase of heat increases all these violent tendencies, so we have this movie which takes place over the course of a day, one day to the next, in a Brooklyn neighborhood with all of these reds and oranges as part of the set design, like the heat just increasing and increasing and increasing. And it's funny because the tension really is between Mookie and Vito or Pino. But that's not where the conflict really ends up, right? Like it's like you see this thing rising and rising and rising between all of this beautifully textured cast of characters, but we are paused in the middle of, like, towards the beginning middle of the movie with that soliloquy from Radio Raheem, and then again he takes us out and breaks the fourth wall with the death of Raheem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because, like, I want to play this song. Why can't I play this song here? Why can't I see my face represented in this space? Well, it's nothing personal, I'm not a bad guy, this is just my preference. Why is that your preference? Mookie goes the next day after throwing a can through Sal's window and demands his pay. He demands his pay, and Sal ends up giving it to him.
Paying him.
He
knows
it,
but it pays him.
So for me, like those other things that I mentioned, those aren't necessarily my opinion. That's just some of the stuff I researched. But when I think about it, I think about the epitaph at the end, where you have a saying by Martin Luther King about nonviolence, juxtaposed with a saying from Malcolm X that says self-defense is necessary. Violence and self-defense is necessary. And the movie doesn't answer the question. At least in all of the watchings that I've given, it doesn't answer the question. For me, what it does is inquires within this specific example and using the themes of space and ownership and race, division, and all that stuff. What does it mean to do the right thing? Aren't we all flawed? Every character in that movie is flawed in a way. They're not fully great people, but they're not fully bad people either. There's some good people there with flaws.
Mm-hmm.
Even in, like, between the mayor, Ossie Davis was married to Ruby Dee, and they're playing the mayor and they're playing Mother Superior.
Mother Sister.
Yeah, Mother Sister. And it's just that relationship is flawed too. They talk shit about each other. They do all, but they're still part of the same community. Even when they were done, they were going to go destroy the Korean store. This rage is taking over. So what does it mean to do the right thing? Where are you morally right? I don't know if there's an answer in this movie. I don't know if Mookie did the right thing. I don't think that he was thinking about Sal's life and redirecting violence when he threw that trash can. It might be an offshoot of it.
Yeah, I don't think so either.
I think it was really a point of all this rage that I have inside me that has been built up by micro infractions over time, or bigger infractions over time, is just getting to a point where this is unacceptable. And to save face, they put him in the back of a police car as a body and drive away with Raheem. I've seen too much. And his expression of it was the release valve for everybody else. Was it the right thing? Yeah. Sal didn't kill Raheem, but did he inadvertently cause his death?
Some thought that.
Yeah. I know that Sal is not feeling great after all of this was done, because he could open up. Why didn't he open up the wall? Why was he so against being told what to do?
But right? Even Sal is privileged without Sal even noticing it. Like we were talking about, like that Me Too moment that I had that I didn't even realize I had. There's Sal is one of the first lines that Sal says in the movie is, "I'm going to kill somebody today." It's at the beginning. It's one of the first scenes in Sal's famous pizzeria where they're trying to figure out who's going to sweep the thing. A Mookie sweep or you sweep Vino. I know Vino. Did you tell Pino? And he's like, "I'm going to kill." But he says it as a frustrated dad. And I don't think I'd ever heard it before. I heard it today. And I was like, well, wait a minute now. Of course, it's foreshadowing. I think that he doesn't realize that his words carry so much weight that he could actually kill somebody. And I'm not saying he's responsible or he killed him or he did anything, but not once, but twice was he about to inflict violence on someone where he was stopped. At the beginning, where the first time that Bugging Out starts talking about the wall and he wants the extra cheese and it's $2, and that whole scene, Sal takes the bat and he's about to hit him with the bat. Pino, not Vito, not the calm one, but Pino takes the bat away from him and gives it to Mookie or, you know, behind the counter to calm the situation, where you would think it's the calmer brother that does that. Two times now that he's gone as the aggressor, not realizing that two of these people he's talking to, we're used to our lives being threatened every day and you get away with it. And I'm not saying he's responsible for it, but they all had a hand in Radio Raheem dying.
Yeah.
All of them, Mookie included. I'm not saying, you know, the hand that took, but they
contributed.
All.
Everybody had an action that led to this point.
Yeah. You know, and it was a nice thread throughout the narrative. But yeah, I find it interesting that Sal can use those words, but I can't. My Black brothers and sisters can't go around saying, "I'm going to kill somebody today," because, you know, if somebody takes them seriously enough, they're going to start recording them and call the cops. Who knows? Like, we don't have the luxury of talking that loosely. And I find it balls on accurate that Spike puts that in Sal's mouth, because he's able to do it. He's able to say it. He's able to get away with it.
There's also that issue of privilege that we were talking about earlier with him being unaware. So he's like, "I'm Italian-American. This is an Italian-American shop. I'm going to have an Italian-American Wall of Fame." But you make your money in a predominantly African-American neighborhood.
That part.
And you are in this space and your patrons are African-American. That, again, raises that question of ownership.
Like, you've employed an African-American. Like, it's not Sal's and Sons. It's Sal's and Sons and Mookie. Like, that's another scene where he's like, "Oh, we're never going to leave here. And I'm going to change the name to Sal's and Sons." And all three of them, there's a pan to the left, to the right. They pan from Vito to Pino to Mookie, and they all looking like, "We don't fucking want to work here. Like, what are you talking about? And we're not brothers. Like, what are you talking about?" So, I mean, he's completely oblivious to his entitlement. I don't think anybody did the right thing, to answer your question in a very long about roundabout way. I don't think anybody did the right thing. I think everything that everybody did led to something else. And I thought that earlier, but are you familiar with the quote that he says about do the right thing in this book?
No.
It's actually a quote by Obama, and it says, "On our first date, I took her to this new movie everybody was talking about, directed by a guy that not too many people had heard of, but it was supposed to be pretty good. So Spike, thank you for helping me impress Michelle. I totally thank you for telling a powerful story. Do the Right Thing still holds up a mirror to our society. It makes us laugh and think and challenges all of us to see ourselves in one another." And of course, that's President Barack Obama that he's got quoting him. No, I mean, the idea that we're able to still today see this and still see these spaces and still see these tensions is the reason that I wanted to talk about this movie tonight and write a poem about it.
So let's talk about this a little bit, and we'll move on to the poems in a second. But there's so much about this movie we haven't talked about. There's so many characters that are amazing. There's so many. I think it's on Netflix right now, if I'm not wrong. Guys, if you haven't seen this movie, watch this movie, right? Like, there's a reason why it's on the Sight and Sound list. There's a reason why it's in the New York Times Best 200 Movies list. There's a reason why it's in all of these lists. It's just incredibly well done. It's Spike Lee developing his style, testing things out, being a storyteller with different things to say. We talk about why you chose to do the right thing, but after this rewatch, is there anything different that you noticed about this movie that calls your attention?
Gosh, it went back to my Blockbuster days. I started looking for Easter eggs. I was like, wait a minute, the battery's expired 3/1991. This came out in 89. Okay, he's not dating Rodney King. That's his birthday, Erica. Like, I went, I went in the weeds, but I pulled back. And this time around, I noticed a lot more of the female characters. I didn't pay a lot of attention to Jade, and shame on me. Shame on me. I felt really guilty about that because I felt like I didn't give credence to the scene where Mookie yanks her by the arm outside by the brick wall and is basically, you know, chastising her and telling her, don't ever come back here again. I don't want to see you like a father. And again, here's a woman being put in her place.
It's more, to me, it goes back to the ownership and who has the space, right? Mookie is should be called Moochie because he's mooching off his sister.
Off of her.
Yeah, he lives with her. He mooches off her. He doesn't, like, he can't support his own kid. And then he feels like because he's the man, he owns the person who pays his bills.
Which is part of the, you know, Latin culture. I'm not going to lie. You got a lot of machismo. Mom making more than dad. That didn't happen in my house. And we knew it. Like, it's not that my dad went around toting it and that, oh, you know, I'm the breadwinner. But we knew he was the breadwinner, even though they both went out and worked. And when he said something, whether she agreed or disagreed with it, it was law. That's what I grew up on. That's what we know as women. And so it takes something else in us for her to turn around and say, no, Mookie, like, get a job, get a life, get out my house. I'm tired of, like, that right there. That was her owning that space. That was her reclaiming that brick wall. He put them up against the brick wall to show that she's not going to pin herself in and she's not going to be pinned in a small closet. That was just the most beautiful thing cinematically. That brick wall behind, and I can't remember what the saying says right now, but it does say something prolific, but something about the truth. But the fact that she's up against the wall, like literally being up against the wall and still pressing the wall to lift her up. And, you know, she told her brother off a few times in the movie. So it's not like we haven't seen her do it. And it's not like this time was any different because he kind of just flicked off. Just don't come over here no more. Go home, you know, and he walked away. She spoke. She was still dismissed. Is it right? No. But is it accurate? Pretty much. Because in some spaces, we still speak up and it don't matter. It doesn't make a difference. That scene to me was like, what?
Yeah, and in my experience, at least with some of the women that I know, they do have power, they do speak up, but then there are no consequences for the Mookies in their life. So they continue to do the same thing. Because if there are no consequences, they won't learn respect. They won't respect their decisions, they won't respect what they're saying. So it's like, okay, I own you, I do whatever. Yeah, keep talking. And Mookie's not an idiot. He's an intelligent character. He knows he's freeloading off his... He knows he doesn't give his all at work. He knows he doesn't really give a shit. All he really is horny. One of his main motivators. I don't really see him care about Hector.
Learn English. I want my son to learn English.
Exactly, right? So, but then for him to think, he knows what situation he's in. But then he's like, oh no, this hurts my ego. I'm going to go over here and handle this. Because you shouldn't be, are you in love with this white man? How dare you? You know, like all, again, ownership of the person who's paying your bills. Like she's a grown ass woman. She can, if she wanted to do that, she can do as she pleases. It's none of his business. But still.
But he makes it so. Yeah, he does it the entire movie. Like he wakes her up at the beginning of the movie. Ironically, I caught this time and you just can't unhear it after you hear it. When he jumps on her back and she's sleeping and he's like, wake up, it's hot. And she's like, I can't breathe because he's on her back like that. And it just, again, that I can't breathe doesn't sound the same to me anymore. And it's just, it happens to be that he plopped on the, you know, she was laying on her stomach and he plopped on her back or whatever. And then she starts coughing because he's like laying on her, kind of like, you know, leaning on. But she says, I can't breathe. Get off of me. It's hot. It brings back a lot of stuff. It brings back hands up. Yeah, don't, it just brings back a lot. So seeing that now, it changes. Seeing sister mother playing a very safe but wise role. I knew she was the matriarch of the film watching it before. I mean, I didn't understand it then the way I understand it now, because now I'm a mother.
Mm.
I think this is the first time I've watched it since I've had both my kids. I have a 10-year-old and a 5-year-old. So it's been a minute since I've watched the movie beginning to end. Yeah, I've caught it when it's on or whatever. But yeah, no, I resonate with her wanting to mother the community. And yeah, you see the mayor as the father of the community. He calls every kid and every Black actor, he calls them doctor. I don't know if you noticed that. I didn't realize that until watching it this time around. And for me, that's kind of like his drunk ass teaching them, you could be more than what you are. I'm going to call you a doctor because you could be a doctor in my head. I know that, you know, we all internalize what we see differently. But in my head, I'm like, I've never seen anybody on, you know, an African-American adult calling a child doctor before. Like that wasn't my upbringing. And here you put in the mouth of babes, like Shakespeare does, and he loves to put the truth in the mouth of the poor and the grave diggers and people like that, putting the truth in the mayor, you know? And the mayor's calling everybody, even the little kid he saves from getting hit by the car. He calls him doctor. Now, you know, you got to watch where you're going. And, you know, so those are the things that jump out at me, those little nuances that I didn't catch so many years ago and before I was a mom. The combing of the hair, when Jade is combing Mother Sister's hair, and she's like, ow, I'm tenderheaded. I can't comb my daughter's hair without her crying. She sees the comb and she starts crying. This is our reality. And they have softer hair than I. And still, it's like the comb. So when I saw that, I was like, oh, okay, I see what they mean. You know, it pulls at my heart. I'm like, you know, they're not making it up. This is not just because people have called our hair kinky and hard and ugly and nappy all this time. It is kinky and coily and nappy, and we have to love it and not be afraid of it. You know, so even in that moment, there's a moment where mother sister's like, I'm tenderheaded. No, you're not tenderheaded. Our hair is just a little different, you know, textured. And so you got to, anyway, it's a girl thing. Trust me. My grandma used to give me a big thing of milk because she said that my head would bobble and the milk would give me strength so that my head wouldn't move. Weird things. But yeah, that resonated with me now because I have kids. And what would it have been like if my parents didn't leave Washington Heights and come to Miami? What would I have been like? Would I have been Tina? Would I have been Ella screaming like, that's all Ella did? No, stop. You know, the chick with the right, back, don't right. do that. You know, even when the mayor was getting cussed out by one of their friends, I can't remember the friend's name, where he was calling him a drunk and you walk up and down the street and all you do is drink. And she's sitting there saying, no, you know, stop. You don't have to do that. She could have pulled him away. Again, this is the space that we occupy. She doesn't have the authority to do such. And he's not going to write it that way because we didn't have the authority. And sometimes it's faces now, we still don't have that authority. So yeah, those are just the little things that just little nuances that popped up at me as I'm watching it again. And overall, I think what made me want to write this piece was the love and the hate. You know, I was like, I don't want to write about the go-to themes of this movie. And I want to try to write a love poem. But like I said, it didn't turn out like a love poem, but it's a love poem and maybe a love cry.
We didn't even talk about the fire hydrant scene and all that stuff.
But oh my God, that scene was awesome.
It was awesome. You know, you mentioned the poem. One of the things I do want to say before we leave this movie, at the end, the epilogue shows Mr. Senor Lovedead. I love saying that name. Samuel L. Jackson announcing that the mayor of New York City has funded a committee to investigate the incident. Thoughts and prayers. But then
For the property.
Yeah, but then he dedicates a song to Raheem. And then we have an epilogue that shows two quotations that demonstrate the dichotomy of the film's theme. One from Martin Luther King, who claims violence is never justified. And one from Malcolm X, who claims violence is intelligence when used in self-defense, and then dedicates the film to 6 Black people, 5 killed by police officers, and they were Eleanor Bumpers, Arthur Miller Jr., Edmund Perry, Yvonne Smallwood, and Michael Stewart, and one killed by a white mob, Michael Griffith, and Annette. And I think if there's anything to take away from this movie is that there are real life tragedies that have inspired the need to express this. When are we going to stop allowing it? Is what I take away from it, right? Because I do feel like we can truly say no more. it takes something. It's not as easy to do that. It takes a lot of courage, but we can easily say like this can't continue to happen.
My boyfriend and I were speaking Thursday night football last Thursday, and he shared with me retired federal government employee. So now he could say whatever he wants to say, and he doesn't have to worry about anybody taking his job away. He said something, and then he just started talking about, you know, working while everybody else is at home, and, you know, the government had to stay open, and he had to put his life basically in danger. And as he spoke, I just started writing my poem. But the quote that he said that made me start writing was how I start my poem. The poem is called "Same Old Shit." They hate us more than they love their own country. And still, with their knees mashed on our necks, unexplainable, Radio Raheem loses his bated breath. 45/47 through paper towels in Maria's name, not Mary, by proxy, a Black woman, mother, sister, most savvy. Mookie's ice cubed, the love below, the hate above. Tina nippled out, circling whilst Bed-Stuy alarms a drought. Italians, Koreans, meat packaged and tariffed. We Black too, brother dearest, have you forgotten? Tina's forest silences, drunk king. The mayor parades odes of unrequited glee. Mother, sister, always watching, obviously. Where the roots of mayor's grassy, opaque trees fold. Fight the police, the radio snared at Smiley. Tina's moans and his stutters grew quietly. We are still here, loving the same place, hating the same race. Hands up, lo están matando, you're killing him, Bed-Stuy mumbled. Mookie, an unreliable father, yet suitable narrator, watches Brooklyn's street die. Garvey struck the gravity, Mookie's declare the severity of Tina's mom's Puerto Rican perigee, towering the trash can crowned high, heart caught in Mookie's pedigree. This ain't no fucking movie. Glass shatters, the voyeurs grow woozy. Tina's heart breaks free for another Spike Lee joint juvie.
I'm going to sit with that one. Thank you, M. I wrote a poem too, and it's called Boombox. Boombox. Boom. Shots. Who gets airtime and who gets dropped? Stopped. Voice muted by a cop. Dreadlock headlock. Litter on the block. Brick-baked baseline breaks down rocks. Body clocked. Trash. Can riot saves life? Headline paradox. One thing, two things, three things mocked. Do the right thing. Walk the talk. Four men, firemen, sidewalk chalk. Blistered sun, crosswalk, aftershock.
Nice. Nice. Oh my gosh. I got goosies. That was tight. Oh my gosh, this was so cool.
M. Sims, please tell us where we can find you on the soche, where we can see what you're doing. Please,
on let us IG, know. It is EM_Sims_creator. Please, please, please hit me up. Facebook, it is the same. It was a pleasure being here. Definitely, definitely hit me up.
Well, it is EM_Sims with 2 M's, _writer_and_creator.
I'm so glad he looked it up. I'm so nervous.
Don't be nervous. And I hope this is, I enjoyed our conversation immensely. I hope that we become great friends, because I hope that this is the first of many conversations. I have a feeling you and I are going to talk movies and art forever if they give us a chance. So
I look forward to it. I seriously do. You are genuinely so dope. I've longed for finding people that have this energy, and every time God brings persons in my way, I'm telling you, you opened your mouth, you said movies, and I looked at my man and I was like, I gotta go talk to him. I don't know what I'm gonna say, but I gotta go talk to him.
He was cool too, man. He was, I saw him. By the way, shout out to Stella from Bloom. Yes. By Stella. She is doing great work by creating spaces in Fort Lauderdale, because Miami is an epicenter, but Fort Lauderdale loves art too. There's a lot of writers in Fort Lauderdale, a lot of poets, a lot of people with something to say. And she is doing a monthly open mic night in the Fort Lauderdale area. And that is where Em and I met. Go look at her at Bloom by Stella. And you can get any information there. If you follow me at RenzoDelCastillo.writer on Instagram, on TikTok, LinkedIn, wherever you want to follow me, Facebook, Threads, anything else, anything the young people are doing. Not Snapchat because I don't trust it.
I don't either. Or the tickety tock tock. I'm sorry. I don't.
It's something I'm a late adopter. I will also post stuff, but that is where we met. And no, I am so glad you did. You came up and had this great idea. I'm so glad for you opening my eyes to how to do the right thing while there is no poet writing. I mean, Radio Raheem's soliloquy to me was a poem. The structure of the movie, how it was done, it was a poem. So thank you very much for opening that up. Again, I do believe we're going to be great friends. Thank you for coming. Not here today, and he's going to be so upset he missed this, but obviously for good reason. It's going to be Scott3T's Raven at Scott3T's Raven and Scott Raven on Instagram. And this was Do the Right Thing with the lovely M. Sims.
Thank you so coming. Much for the opportunity.
Real Poets is produced and hosted by Renzo del Castillo and Scott Raven. Original music composed by Gabby Weitzenfeld. Episode art and visuals by the Real Poets team. New episodes come out every other Thursday. Hit subscribe, download the episode, and leave a review to help us grow. This has been a Real Poets production. And remember to always keep it real.
Yo. Where's Brooklyn at? I said, where's Brooklyn at? Geographically speaking, where is Brooklyn on a map? Brooklyn is located at latitude 40.672 north and longitude 73.9442 degrees west, right in the northern hemisphere of Kings County of New York State. Built upon a history of native displacement, it was originally settled by the Canarsie First Nations. Soon, farms became factories, with city skyscrapers replacing forests and rural landscapers. The Dutch hang around to divide it into six towns, and things get skittish when it's fought over and taken by the British. Eventually, the Treaty of Paris is signed, and things start to fall into FNRLJZ2345 lines. And we get the B, the R, the O, the O, K. LYN is the place where I stay. That's not me, but Yasin Bey, from back in the day, when he was still most deaf. I used to live in Williamsburg, but even my hipsterific ass left. I technically wasn't really a hipster, even though I moved into a two-bed when the Polish family of four there had to go. And only now do I actually know that band, poet, movie, show that you pretended to know. I also couldn't grow a full beard until a few years ago. It was just a goatee that never quite connected. Brooklyn. Where I watched The Wire and celebrated Obama getting elected. Back in the burg, my living room was more narrow than most politicians on both sides of the divide, and every day I'd either run to McCarran Park or take a bike ride. Winters, I worked out at the Y, Videology to Roebling T, Monkey Town, San Loco to C. Yo, is Brooklyn in the house? Loft space / apartment complex / bar cafe / performance venue. BK's not BK, but now both got Beyond Burgers on the menu. BK has changed. I've changed, and mostly for the best. It takes you, chews you, holds you, molds you wherever you came from. It proves to you the best is yet to come. My dentist was in Brooklyn. It's where I got my teeth cleaned and cavities filled. Crown Heights sound like the roof of someone's mouth, but it's where just last year 7 people were killed. Bush Wick sounds like shrubbery with a little tail, or Keanu Reeves' alter ego played by Gavin Rosdale. But this little town in the woods now has a thriving art scene and a raised rail. Peter S. served as its last director, which is why Bed-Stuy is not the eye rash you get from your mattress, but where Bedford and Stuyvesant matches. Now I wonder, what do they throw on the ice when an Islander gets a hat trick? A Junior's cheesecake? A Nathan's hot dog? Forget about it. Wouldn't it be hip if the Barclay was made of adobe and Johnny Greenwood Cemetery played nothing but Radiohead and Moby? What if a happily married Bill and Hillary lived in Clinton Hill and we went to Borum for a cheap thrill? Honestly, I'm not sure yet what any of this means, so make some noise if I should move from Kings County to Queens. To Staten Island, or back to Manhattan, then the Bronx. Brooklyn. It's different now, it was different then. It's changed, and I've changed, and it will change again. I've grown in so many ways, maybe even regressed in others. From brand spanking New Jersey to a bluish red orangey rust. The best of Brooklyn's not the buildings, but the us.